So our speaker is Mick Armstrong. Mick is one of the founding members of Socialist Alternative and an activist and a socialist for years and years and years around a whole series of
Just take it away.
I'll just wait a sec.
I just introduced the session, but I'll do it again because there's some important information. So firstly, important information number one, my name's Yasmin, I'm from the Melbourne branch, Socialist Alternative. I'm going to be chairing and facilitating the discussion of the session. So the piece of information, firstly, if you only have a one-day ticket for the Socialism Conference, it'll be continuing tomorrow. You can upgrade your ticket for $10 if you're a high school student, or $15. If you're not, and we highly encourage you to come back tomorrow. And also after this session, we'll be all heading to the Courtyard Cafe on campus, just a few minutes away, where there'll be cheap food, bar, and we'll be continuing on the political discussions that we've been having today. So Mick's going to give the introduction to the session about Palestine and the Arab Revolution, so hope you're all in the right place.
Okay, well, the demonstrations a few months ago now on the Gaza border were truly heroic. Despite murderous sniper fire by the Israeli military, tens of thousands of Palestinians prepared to demonstrate and make an inspiring stand. And in a whole series of ways, these protests were a very important step forward. They were a mass action organised by grassroots organisations, not some isolated guerrilla attack or random rocket fire. Furthermore, the protests re-raised a very important demand, the right of the Palestinian people to return to their homeland, and this was a demand which had largely been abandoned by the Palestinian leadership in the wake of the Oslo so-called peace accords and their embrace of the so-called two-state solution. You know, they're settling for a pathetic mini-state on the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, policed by the Israelis, which would provide nothing to the mass of Palestinian refugees living in squalor in the refugee camps in Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. The major limitation, however, of these amazing protests was that, unlike so many previous protests, they were unable to galvanise and inspire mass actions throughout the Arab world, or even in Jordan or in the refugee camps. And this is a very serious problem for the Palestinian liberation movement, as the Palestinians locked up in the world's largest prison camp in Gaza do not have the social power on their own to defeat the might of the Israeli state and its US imperialist backers. To do that will take the combined might of the working classes and peasantry of the Arab world, and above all, the Egyptian working class. Now, the enormous setbacks the Arab revolutions have suffered over the last few years clearly an important explanation for this lack of mass support. You know, they have led to widespread popular demoralisation. But there are also important longer-term factors, which I'd argue explain the failure of these protests to achieve the sort of inspiring mobilisations throughout the region we've seen in previous years. And that is the abject failure of the political currents which have so long been dominant throughout the Arab world and in the Palestinian milieu as well. You know, whether it be the various nationalist currents, the Nasserites, the Baathists and so on, or the Stalinist Communist Party, which long dominated the left in the region, and compounded in more recent years by the failure of the Islamist currents. Now, in this talk, I'll be examining the history, traditions and political developments of the main Palestinian political organisations and offer a socialist alternative. Now, for decades, the main political force amongst the Palestinians was Fatah, which also dominated the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. Today, of course, there is very little popular enthusiasm for Fatah, which now operates essentially as the corrupt police force on the West Bank, serving the interests of the Israelis. Yet, despite this, Fatah still remains the popular support of large sections of the Palestinian bourgeoisie. And this bourgeois backing has been key to understanding the politics and trajectory of Fatah over decades. Indeed, it was the decision of the majority of the Palestinian bourgeoisie in the 1960s to swing their support behind the idea of a Palestinian state that gave Fatah a decisive advantage over the other Palestinian political groupings. Considerable sections of the Palestinian rich had survived the Zionist takeover of the bulk of historical Palestine much more successfully than the bulk of the peasantry, the working class and the urban poor. And they went on to prosper in the surrounding Arab states in the 1950s and early 1960s as the oil boom took off. Palestinian bankers, financiers, merchants and construction companies and so on had prospered under British rule, especially during World War II. And they escaped the Zionist takeover with much of their capital intact because it had been invested in London. And by 1948, the Palestinian bourgeoisie was much more advanced than the bourgeoisies of most of the rest of the Arab world, in particular in comparison to the bourgeoisie, well, the nascent bourgeoisie hadn't even really formed in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Two Palestinian-owned banks, the Intra Bank and the Arab Bank, became major players in the 1950s. Palestinian capitalists owned Middle Eastern airlines. Major insurance companies and were able to establish a series of contracting companies, construction companies and transport companies that took advantage of the oil boom. And Palestinian capitalists were better placed than local capitalists because they were English-speaking by and large, more experienced with capitalism, better educated and more westernised, and consequently were preferred by oil companies like Aramco, which dominated the Saudi Arabian oil fields, and by the governments of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait and the Gulf states. This was all in sharp contrast to the treatment and the conditions of the majority, the great majority of the Palestinian population, the peasants, the landless labourers, the unskilled workers, who were left to rot in refugee camps. And consequently, it was only a small minority of the Palestinian elite that got involved in nationalist politics during the 1950s and early 60s. They concentrated on making money and fitting in. This was to change in the course of the 1960s, with the rise of bourgeois competitors in Saudi Arabia and other Arab states, who began to squeeze the Palestinian bourgeoisie and middle class. Governments replaced restrictions on Palestinians and favoured locals. As well, the nationalisations carried out by a series of new nationalist regimes in Syria, Iraq and Egypt restricted the space for Palestinian capitalists. And the collapse of the intrabank in the mid-1960s and the failure of the Lebanese state to bail it out marked an important turning point. A section of Palestinian capitalists now concluded that they needed their own state to defend their class interests. The other section of the Palestinian population that had done well after 1948 were the landowners on the West Bank. They benefited from the misery by employing the Palestinian refugees as cheap labour in the agricultural fields. And consequently, the landowners in the West Bank remained loyal to the Jordanian king, King Hussein, and hostile to the Palestinian nationalists. Indeed, they remained loyal to the Jordanian king even after the Israeli invasion during the 1967 war and backed the king in the 1970 crackdown and massacre of Palestinians. But by 1974, things had shifted. And even the landowners on the West Bank went over to the idea of having their own state in the West Bank and Gaza. This had been spurred on in part by a growing radicalisation amongst the Palestinian working class in the West Bank and the peasantry, and, of course, in the refugee camps. The landowners now feared isolation and started to provide funds to Fatah, which had by now proved itself as a reliable force in defending the interests of the Palestinian bourgeoisie. Fatah's whole approach reflected its bourgeois orientation. It could seem very radical in its early years as it talked of revolution and armed struggle. But it emphasised the need for national unity of all classes to fight the Zionists, i.e. that the working class should subordinate itself to the Palestinian elite. Fatah was never socially radical. It rejected class politics and proclaimed itself as a non-ideological broad church, as distinct from the Palestinian left-wing organisations such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine or the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Fatah was critical of the Arab regimes for not advancing Palestinian interests, but said that Palestinians needed their own armed force. But it was never prepared to break completely with the Arab regimes. It wanted to pressure them. And that meant it was not go as far as organising seriously, let alone organising to overthrow these reactionary regimes. And again, this reflected the interests of the Palestinian bourgeoisie. They wanted their own state. I saw the need for armed struggle, if there was any possibility of achieving it. But they did not want to imperil their position in the Arab world. And they definitely did not want to see social revolutions which would threaten their economic interests in the region. But even Fatah's limited program led to repeated clashes between the PLO and the Arab regimes. To have any hope of being successful, the PLO had to establish a mass popular base. This terrified the Arab states because even a limited Palestinian mobilisation could inspire broader resistance to these regimes. And this put the PLO in a difficult position because unlike other national liberation movements, it needed the Arab states for organisational bases. So either the PLO had to restrict their activity to what the regimes would accept, or they would risk savage defeats, such as in Jordan during Black September in 1970, or in the savage defeat later in the 70s in Lebanon when the Syrians invaded to crush them. The result was that Fatah, over time, narrowed their vision. Talk of revolution went by the board. Armed struggle was increasingly subordinated to diplomacy, to reliance on the Arab states, and on the United States to supposedly act as an honest broker with the Israelis. Talk of a democratic secular state was dropped in favour of a mini-state. In reality, little more than a Bantustan like existed in apartheid South Africa. Fatah ended up being the corrupt administrators of the Palestinian Authority, a police force over the Palestinian population on behalf of the Israelis and the US. This approach, nonetheless, dovetailed with the interests of the Palestinian bourgeoisie on the West Bank and in Jordan. Yasser Arafat, the long-term leader of Fatah and the PLO, typified these developments. Arafat came from an upper-middle-class background. He was part of the Husseini family, one of the most prominent Palestinian elite families. Arafat fought the Israelis in 1948 and subsequently, while studying in Egypt, joined the Muslim Brotherhood. He then worked as an engineer in Kuwait where he set up a very successful business and used its funds to begin to fund Fatah when it was formed in the mid-1950s. Fatah engaged in limited arms struggle from the mid-1960s onwards, and in 1969 took over control of the PLO, which had been set up originally by the Arab states to contain and limit the Palestinian struggle. Fatah's call for a return to the land of Palestine won mass support in the refugee camps. And with now money coming in, they managed to build up services in the camps and effectively created a state within a state, first in Jordan and later in Lebanon. The defeat of the Arab armies and the 1967 war with Israel strengthened Fatah's position. The Arab regimes was now seen as abject failures when it came to standing up to the Israelis. And then came the Battle of Karameh in 1968, when a band of Fatah Fedayeen withstood an Israeli attack. And this gave Fatah immense prestige, and thousands flooded in to join its guerrilla army. In the aftermath, pretty much immediately afterwards, a revolutionary situation developed in Jordan, where the mass of the population is Palestinian. But Fatah and Arafat refused to mobilise the PLO, and the Jordanian king managed to regroup and crush the revolt. Subsequently, the PLO retreated to Lebanon, where the pattern repeated itself. A mass radicalisation swept Lebanon in the course of the 1960s and 1970s and led to a revolutionary situation and the outbreak of a revolutionary civil war. And Arafat initially kept the PLO out of the main part of the fighting. It was only after the right-wing fascists started to carry out massacres in the Palestinian refugee camps that the PLO unleashed its massive military might. But then, with the left on the verge of victory, almost triumphant, the Assad regime in Syria invaded to shore up the right, and Arafat acquiesced to the invasion. The end result was that the PLO was driven out of Lebanon by the combined forces of Israel and Syria cooperating and forced into exile in Tunisia. The PLO's fortunes were subsequently revived by the first intifada that broke out, the mass revolt that broke out in 1987, but they used that mass popular revolt to lay the basis for an appalling betrayal, the Oslo Accords, and a Palestinian Middle East state in the West Bank and Gaza. And from then on, it was downhill at a very rapid rate. Fatah was prepared to accept any scraps that were thrown to it in return for becoming the police force over the Palestinian population. And one consequence of that was the sharp decline of the secular nationalist movement and the subsequent rise of Hamas. But just like Fatah, Hamas refuses to mobilise the mass of the Palestinian people on a class basis to confront imperialism, and it refuses to call on the working classes of the regions to rise up against the reactionary Arab regimes that are allied to imperialism. So Hamas, just like Fatah, can't offer a road forward for the liberation of the Palestinian people. To the extent that Hamas does fight, it alienates the surrounding Arab states such as Egypt, which have forged very strong alliances with Israel. And that in turn pressures Hamas to seek compromises with the Israelis to try to reach a compromise with the despised Fatah. But what then of the Palestinian left? There was a powerful force in the 1960s and 70s and even into the 1980s. Unfortunately, the Palestinian left, like most of the left in the Arab world from the 1930s onwards, was dominated politically by Stalinism and consequently adopted a class collaborationist popular front strategy. The leader of the Syrian Communist Party outlined what this popular front approach meant in practice in a speech in 1953, where he declared, "We Arabs have but one path. The path of a broad united front, a national front, which must unite the workers, peasants, middle strata of the urban population, and large sections of the national bourgeoisie. And it was not just the official communist parties that adhered to this class collaborationist Popular Front strategy, but all, unfortunately, of the various radical current that emerged in the course of the 1960s. The influence of the Palestinian Communist Party had been badly hurt by the Russian support, and very strong support indeed, for the establishment of the State of Israel. And so, consequently, the radical groups that emerged amongst the Palestinians in the late 1960s, the Popular Front and the Democratic Front, were not direct descendants of the Palestinian Communist Party. They emerged instead as breaks from the pan-Arabist wing of the nationalist movement, the ANM, the Arab National Movement. The ANM was initially fairly conservative politically, but they evolved in a more radical direction. The ANM backed Nasser's radical nationalist regime in Egypt, and by the late 1950s was beginning to refer to itself as socialist. After the defeat of the Arab armies in the 1967 war with Israel, they became more critical of Nasser and began to look to Vietnam and China. The Popular Front was formed in December 1967, and the Democratic Front about 18 months later in February 1969. The Democratic Front was initially influenced by new left ideas of the 60s period and was less militarist than the Popular Front. The Democratic Front was for a socialist state, part of a federal socialist state of the Middle East, and it saw an independent Palestinian state as a utopia. However, in the wake of the bad defeat at Black September in 1970 in Jordan, the Democratic Front moved to the right and towards a pro-Moscow Stalinist position. It also should be noted there was a strong pro-Moscow Stalinist wing in Fatah itself, which was, by this stage was receiving very substantial Russian aid, and where leading figures in Fatah were sent to Eastern Europe for political miseducation. The Democratic Front was become the trailblazer for popularising the idea of a Palestinian mini-state. It had significant influence amongst the Arab intelligentsia and provided a left cover for Fatah, which was moving more cautiously towards the two states position. On the other hand, the Popular Front, while highly critical of the reactionary Arab regimes, such as Saudi Arabia, was soft on the supposed radical regimes in Algeria, in Yemen, Syria, and even Iraq, from which it received substantial sums of money for a period. But none of these regimes, of course, were genuine supporters or allies of the Palestinian liberation cause. The Popular Front for a period also had close relations with China. The Popular Front rapidly established strong support in the refugee camps. And when its influence peaked in the lead-up to Black September, it was a serious rival to Fatah, and it carried out the bulk of fighting against the Jordanian army and was badly hurt in that fighting. It subsequently went on to engage in a series of plane hijackings, which was a serious mistake. Following the defeat of the Arab armies in the 1973 war, Arafat now openly backed the mini-state solution, and the Popular Front joined the Rejection Front to argue against Fatah's capitulation. But after 1978, the Popular Front softened its stance and became less critical of Fatah and continually called for the national unity of all the Palestinian people. The trajectory was clear, and when the Palestinian Authority was established, it came really as no surprise that the Popular Front accepted it. Its failure to build a class struggle alternative to Fatah led to a sharp decline of its membership and further opened up space for Hamas. So after decades of heroic struggle by the Palestinian masses, no revolutionary force has been built to take advantage of the innumerable opportunities that have arisen in these years to form an alliance between the Palestinian struggle and the tens of millions of exploited workers and peasants throughout the Arab world. The classic example, of course, was in Lebanon, where, as I said, a mass radicalisation swept the country in the course of the 1960s and 70s. A poll in Beirut in 1968 showed that 93% of Muslims and 64% of Christians strongly backed the Palestinian guerrilla fighters. In 1973, a quarter of a million Lebanese, a tenth of the total population, marched in protest after the Israelis assassinated three Palestinian leaders. And the tensions exploded in mass strikes and a revolutionary upsurge in 1975, which led to the breakout of civil war between left and right. The Lebanese army was torn apart as the great bulk of the rank-and-file soldiers defected to the side of the revolution. The mainstream of the PLO refused to join the struggle immediately and only did so in the face of the fascist attacks on the PLO, on the Palestinian camps. And once they did, a left-wing victory seemed assured. But fearing that the revolution would spill over from Lebanon into Syria, the Syrian army now invaded with the backing of the Americans and the acquiescence of the Israelis to prop up the right. The Syrian invasion initially ran into serious trouble, and the mass of the initial Syrian troops that came in defected to the revolution. And they were only able to eventually conquer on the basis that the PLO ordered its forces to stop fighting. And this was far from being the only occasion on which the Palestinian leadership threw away its opportunity to form an alliance with the Arab masses and open up the possibility of the overthrow of the Israeli regime and the mass of the reactionary Arab states that are allied to it. Time and time again, the Palestinian resistance has inspired workers throughout the region to fight for their rights. In 1953, it was Palestinian workers in Saudi Arabia that led a series of mass strikes in the oil fields. It was a wave of revolt by the Palestinians that almost overthrew the Jordanian regime in 1970. And the scale of support was reflected, I think, in 1982 when the PLO had been driven out of Lebanon, when a shipload of Palestinian fighters going from Lebanon was being taken to Yemen. And 1 million Egyptians lined the banks of the Suez Canal to show their solidarity with the Palestinian fighters. The first Intifada in 1987 and the second Intifada in 2000 saw waves of protests across Tunisia, Iraq, Kuwait and Morocco, which provoked sharp repression by the Arab regimes. In Egypt, tens of thousands of workers at the Mahalla al-Kubra textile factory went on strike in support of the Palestinian cause, but also to advance their own struggles and living conditions in the face of the brutal Mubarak regime. The regimes, in turn, used the Palestinian leadership, the PLO leadership, to try to contain the revolts. Yasser Arafat himself went to Kuwait in the wake of demonstrations there and appeared alongside the horrendous royal family. In October 1988, Algeria erupted in a monumental struggle with mass strikes, demonstrations and widespread rioting. And it took many weeks for the army to regain control. And again, the regime's leadership looked to the PLO leaders to contain the revolt. The underlying basis for solidarity between the Palestinian national struggle and the struggle of the Arab working class is the fact that the brutal regimes that oppress and exploit workers in Egypt, in Saudi Arabia and the Arab states are welded into the same imperialist world order that props up the state of Israel. All these regimes are vitally dependent upon the US for financial and military support to crush popular revolts at home and have become open allies of the Zionist state. After years of inspiring struggle, the wave of revolt that swept the Arab world and brought down the regimes in Tunisia and initially in Egypt have been brutally pushed back. But the counter-revolution cannot last indefinitely. The underlying causes of the rebellions are the poverty, the mass unemployment, the lack of basic social services, low wages, no democratic rights, and so on, have not been resolved. Indeed, they've been aggravated by the counter-revolution. Inevitably, another round of revolt will sweep the region. And the key task then remains the building of a revolutionary left that can unite a renewed revolutionary wave with the Palestinian cause and shake the very foundation of the imperialist order. And I'll leave it there.